welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a wonderful weekend. Thanks for joining us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Helping Little Learners. It's part two of our conversation with North Dakota Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth, and she'll share practical ways parents can build curiosity, confidence, and strong learning habits as young children head back to school. And we begin Main Street today with a question. Is now the time to share your medical records with ChatGPT? Artificial intelligence is becoming increasingly personal. ChatGPT can now connect directly to supported medical records, allowing patients to ask questions about their lab results, medications, and health history. The potential is significant. AI could help people understand medical language, identify trends, and prepare for appointments, but medical records contain some of our most sensitive information, and an AI-generated answer can sound authoritative even when it's incomplete or maybe even wrong. So what should patients consider before making that connection? And how should doctors respond when patients bring AI-generated health information into the exam room? Dr. David Kuntzman is an Associate Medical Informatics Officer for Essentia Health. He joins us to discuss the opportunities, limitations, and privacy questions surrounding AI and our medical records. Dr. David Kuntzman, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here today.
I am so pleased that you are with us to talk about this topic. We broached it a couple weeks ago in our Tech with Peck segment, and now we're going to learn from someone who's in the biz, so to speak. When you first heard that patients could connect to their medical records directly to a consumer AI tool like ChatGPT, what went through your mind?
Well, my first reaction was, wow, this is really powerful. I can see why patients want it. So this is a tool that can help us organize and explain health information across all sorts of portals, health applications, and even the wearables that we have these days. But on the flip side, my family medicine brain goes to context and what the patient does next. So it kind of reminds me of a story from when I was in med school. So when I was scouring those textbooks, which is what we had in the day, I developed fatigue and I was convinced I had malaria. And so never mind the fact that I was in Wisconsin and I hadn't traveled anywhere where malaria was. I had plenty of information, but I really didn't have context. And my doctor at the time, he assured me, helped me navigate the situation and said, you know, maybe those 50 to 60 hours of studying you're doing probably could cause some fatigue as well. And so that's really the challenge today. It's AI gives people plenty of information, but it doesn't necessarily provide the context. And for us in healthcare, that's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to help put all that information in context.
On a very basic level, I would be curious, do you recommend this? But for someone who has never tried this, what actually happens when a patient connects to a medical record and an AI system? What happens there?
Sure. Well, when a patient signs in to something like ChatGPT, you can then go to a screen to give authorization for connecting to your health app or your electronic health record through an organization that you belong to. Once you're connected, then you decide what information as part of that medical record you're going to allow that company, such as ChatGPT, to have access to before you can start asking questions. But then after that, you can ask the questions like, you know, summarize my results, compare things from year to year, or, you know, give me some easy questions to ask my provider next time I'm in.
So is this a substitute? Are you worried that some people will use instead of asking those very same questions to their doctor?
Well, that is certainly a risk. We know patients are already doing this. So about roughly a third of patients have tried using a large language model like ChatGPT to get information about their health. And we know a subset of those folks have actually made their own medical decision based on the information that they've received. What's missing then is the context, you know, so is this a complete medical record? Do we have all the information correct when we're asking the question? And I'd hate for people to make a decision based on that, you know, incomplete knowledge or incomplete context.
So then what do you see the greatest potential for AI to help patients better understand and manage their health.
Wow, you know, that huge potential. You know, the way I look at it is this will help a patient have a better understanding and be able to generate better questions. And so when they come in, they're able to more participate in their care and have a better conversation with their clinician.
Suppose a patient receives that lab result. It's unfamiliar with all of the numbers and the medical terminology that's in that lab result. How do you anticipate AI could reasonably help the person understand so that then they could have a better conversation with the doctor? How do you see that process playing out almost in real time?
Yeah, I love it when patients bring in information like this. You know, it used to be, you know, Dr. Google, and now people are coming in with more of a, I would say, here's what I'd like to do, doctor, based on what I've learned in ChatGPT. And I love it when folks bring that in. And my biggest opportunity is to sit down and go, what did you ask? What did it tell you? And what are you planning to do from that? And really create more of a safe space and a safe pathway to better care.
Is it your perception that AI can recognize meaningful trends across several years of test results that might be a portal, if you will, into a better way to analyze information than perhaps a physician has the time to look at in the time that we would be sharing in an appointment? Or does it require more clinical context that only the physician can provide?
Well, ChatGPT and other large language models are really good at spotting trends and patterns. And so I can absolutely see it doing something like that. My biggest concern is that it looks at a complete record. And so when you sign up with ChatGPT Health, you're allowed to kind of specify what information you're willing to share. And you also could have been seen at different organizations, and maybe you choose to share one organization and not another. If we start to look at trends over time, we want to have a complete record. And that's where a clinician really can help with kind of navigating that, giving it context, saying, hey, what about the time that you were seen out in, California? You know, do we have those records here? And do we need to really think about that as well?
Dr. David Knutsman is my guest. He's the Associate Chief Medical Informatics Officer for Essentia Health. And we're talking about opportunities, maybe limitations and privacy questions surrounding AI being connected directly to our medical records. So we all have learned, I think, that AI sounds pretty darn smart. It sounds very confident when it gives us an answer, really polished. What might be missing from answers when it appears so convincing relative to our medical record?
Right. Well, what I see with some of these is the biggest risk would be self-confidence or false confidence. The most dangerous answer that we can get from ChatGPT or something similar isn't completely wrong. And that's really the danger, is that it's mostly right, but it's really confidently delivered. So you're going to believe it, but there's going to be one important thing that might be wrong, and that could really change your outcome or kind of what you do next.
From a clinician's perspective, is it still a risk today that AI could overlook something and then misunderstand a medical note or perhaps reach the wrong conclusion? Or, doctor, are you more confident today that it can get things right?
Yeah, it can certainly it can certainly miss small clinical details, because one individual word in a large paragraph, if it's put in the right place, it could really create a whole different meaning. And if ChatGPT or something similar picks that up, it's not really just creating some false information. It's kind of a mixed truth. My goal in healthcare then is to verify that information with the patient directly, and if need be, reach out and get the right information.
One question that I've just thought about is that my provider at Essentia is now using an AI tool to listen to our time together and generate the note. So it's using AI to generate something that will be part of our record that then perhaps AI might interpret. How have you found its ability to generate an accurate note?
Well, so the the technology is called ambient documentation, I think it's been a revolution in healthcare. It's really allowed, at least me personally, and I think a lot of other folks, to sit and listen to our patients a little bit more like we used to, really take into the conversation. I do find it is very accurate. It seems to pull in the conversations very accurately, but ultimately it's still that clinician's responsibility to verify that it gets the language correct and that it doesn't insert something that wasn't said correctly or didn't hear correctly. And so that's a conversation we have with patients all the time, take a look at your note, make sure that it makes sense to you, and we have our clinicians do the same.
Dr. Knutson, you mentioned earlier that as you attach your medical records, if you make that decision to do so to an AI system, that you can choose what to share. So are there certain records or health questions that patients should be cautious about asking AI to connect to or to interpret?
I think the biggest risk is, well, it's twofold. It's two-sided, really. You could overshare information could potentially put that information at risk because you're giving your information to a third party. They're governed by privacy laws, but they're not the same privacy laws that healthcare providers are governed by. So HIPAA is what governs privacy within healthcare. And you want to treat that information that you're giving to this third party private as you would with your healthcare provider. So you want to make sure that making a unique password for it, doing two-factor authentication when you can, making sure that your operating systems and your applications are up to date. And then actually the thing I probably find myself doing more often than not is, you haven't used a certain application for a certain amount of time. You probably need to get rid of it and make sure that it gets rid of the data as well.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. What should someone do if AI suggests the test result is alarming, or just as importantly, assumes that something is harmless? That's probably, I think, a case I'd be more concerned about. What should patients bring to a physician? How do we know how to use AI and what it's telling us to bring to you in a way that makes our care better?
I really appreciate it when people bring in really the full question and answer that they're getting from their ChatGPT or similar technology. So if I'm doing my job right, I'm going to ask, what's the question you ask? What did the application say? What are the options? What are you planning to do? And how can we make this a safe space to move forward? And certainly if something comes up concerning, my first inkling is usually pick up the phone and let's have a conversation. So you're not sitting there thinking about it or worrying about it.
Do you perceive that this will increase trust between patients and physicians, or the opposite, weaken trust?
I think initially we're going to see that both patients and clinicians need to figure out this new reality. We're going to be using our AI tools. Patients are going to be using their AI tools, and I think there's a space for us to use them together. And we're going to pick up things maybe the LLM doesn't pick up, and ChatGPT or the LLM is going to pick up things that we don't pick up. And I think it's a collaboration.
You mentioned that different rules protect the patient when they're working with Essentia, but those rules are different when they're working with ChatGPT. Can you give us a little more understanding about what those protections should mean to us when we voluntarily share information with a big consumer technology company?
Right. So treat it like your medical record, like you would secure your medical record in Epic. That's called MyChart. So have a strong password. Have multi-factor authentication when you can. Keep all your devices updated. And then when you're using an application, you also want to ask yourself, You know, how do they keep your data? What do they do with your data? And then how easy is it for me to have that data erased? And how easy is it for me to have my entire account erased from that application?
In your role as Chief Medical Informatics Officer, how are you helping Essentia Health as a company think through the benefits and risks of this rapidly changing technology?
So my role is to keep that conversation around AI tied to care and workflow and also trust, both on a clinician side and on a patient side. So that really means asking some very practical questions. What problems are we trying to solve? When we get an answer from AI, where does that go? And really, who owns that workflow? So if you get an answer and it doesn't go anywhere, or doesn't do anything, it's probably not going to be helpful for us. And then on the back end, how do we monitor performance? And that's actually a big focus of what we do is we're looking at, you know, is it giving you a consistent answer that makes sense, or is it slipping from time to time? Another thing we have built in to healthcare tools a lot is when does a human need to step into that workflow? So Epic has a product called Emmy, which I can go into a little bit more, if it senses that we're kind of going down a bad path or there's some potential risk involved, it can automatically kind of move that to a 24-hour or, 24/7 nurse line to kind of help, take away that concern that you're bringing up with Emmy at the time or my chart.
Are you worried that some of your patients are going to have great internet access and connectivity? They understand the digital world as these new tools become available, but others may not and may be left out.
Right. So I think AI can help us improve access ultimately, but really only if we design it for those people who need it the most. So it's especially true with Essentia. So about 90% of our patient population lives in a rural area. They face, the long travel distances, the limitations of broadband support. They just simply don't have the opportunities to ask as many questions because of that inaccessibility. And so AI can be a real tremendous help in those situations. It can maybe answer some of those questions that they would have answered if they were in person, but really only if we build it correctly. And, we make sure that we look out for those folks who aren't quite as digitally savvy.
So if an Essentia patient asks you today, should I connect my medical record to ChatGPT? How would you answer?
For the most part, I would first have them ask the question, what's the problem they're trying to solve? And if the goal is really just understanding information, organizing kind of their records, comparing results over time, or maybe preparing questions for their provider, then I'd say ChatGPT or similar could be a very useful tool. If the goal, though, is figuring out what are you going to do next and how are you going to schedule that follow-up care, how's it going to fit in my treatment plan, how's it going to interact with my care team that I'm seeing, then I would generally start with the MyChart tool called Emmy. And just maybe to explain that, Emmy is a digital front door to healthcare that's designed by Epic. It's available through MyChart, and it's connected to things in the medical record like the clinical notes, the scheduling, the billing, and so it helps answer those questions and navigate patients to the right resources. What makes it different, it's designed to work alongside the care team and not really replace it, but it also has those important safety checks and that human backup built into it.
Dr. David Kutzman is an Associate Chief Medical Informatics Officer for Essentia Health. ChatGPT Health is designed to support and not replace professional medical care is one thing I think I've taken away from this. It's been a pleasure to visit with you about this on Main Street, and I have a feeling this conversation's not over. As we wrap it up, if there's a place that someone should go to learn more about this, what would you tell them?
It's pretty easy to find the information. I'm gonna say there's two places to maybe go. One is you can go to the Essentia Health website and their My Chart section and learn more about My Chart and Emmy. And then certainly you can look at ChatGPT Health and kind of really take it all in and see what it has to offer, what are its limitations, what data does it cover, and what privacy do you gain from it or don't gain from it. I think all of these tools are super important. I'm optimistic. I think AI can help patients really better understand their health information, organize their questions, and really come into the visits more prepared. So that's a good thing.
Did you think we'd be having this conversation just 5 years ago, Doctor?
Absolutely not.
Technology changes. Thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Cool. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
FM Kicks Band presents the David Ferreira Toast Concert Thursday, August 20th at 7:30 p.m. at the TAC Music Venue featuring David Ferreira. Community members of all ages are welcome. Information at fmkicksband.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Synthetic fabrics like polyester and nylon have steadily pushed cotton out of American closets, contributing to decades of a stagnant demand and a sharp decline in cotton processing facilities. As Harvest Public Media's Michael Marks reports, industry leaders are turning to Congress, new marketing campaigns, and concerns about microplastics to help American cotton regain lost control.
For most of cotton's history, people have only wanted more of it. The world's textile mills demanded more cotton every year until 2006. That was the peak.
You know, you'd have to look at it and say over the last 20 years, we actually haven't had any growth.
That's Hank Reichel, CEO of Staple Cotton, a marketing co-op that exports American cotton around the globe. He says the stagnation is because clothing makers replaced cotton with man-made materials like nylon or polyester. Those are easier to work with and often cheaper.
Certainly what we've seen over the last 20, 30 years is a big increase in synthetic textiles versus cotton.
During that time, the whole U.S. cotton industry has downsized. In 1991, the U.S. Department of Agriculture counted more than 1,500 cotton processors. Now, there are just over 400. This trend has caught the attention of people in Washington, like Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins.
Now, we are working to reverse course. Today, USDA is announcing our new Great American Cotton Plan.
The plan is a multi-part strategy by the department to increase demand for the fiber and profits for farmers. One piece is to support a bill called the Buying American Cotton Act, which would offer tax breaks to manufacturers for using U.S.-grown cotton.
What the act does, basically, is it says, okay, look, even if you're a Chinese mill and you're sourcing and using U.S. cotton, to the extent you're using that in your product, you come back, you get a tax credit.
That's Darren Hudson, agricultural economics professor at Texas Tech University.
I can bid more for those U.S. bales because I know I'm going to get a tax credit on the back end.
It's an exciting prospect for folks in the cotton business like Seth Stevens, general manager of United Agricultural Cooperative, a farm service company in El Campo, Texas.
It has a whole trickling effect across the industry. I mean, prices have a good shot to rise. More acres are going to be put in the ground, and that's going to equate to more cotton to gin, right? So the effects of it will be large.
The bill is still waiting for hearings in the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, but has dozens of co-sponsors from both parties. But that's not the only effort to revitalize American cotton. Cotton boosters are trying to claw back sales they've lost to synthetic fibers by suggesting those fabrics aren't healthy for you.
With every step, every breath, every heartbeat, microplastics escape from our clothes into the air.
This is from an ad by the National Cotton Council. It's part of a new campaign called Plant Not Plastic, which portrays cotton as a safer alternative to man-made fabrics. It has the backing of the USDA.
Choose cotton. What you wear matters. Plant, not plastic.
Microplastic pollution is the cotton industry's counterargument to synthetic fibers, and the message is starting to gain some traction, according to garment makers like Marta Miller.
We're finding big demand currently with people wanting to have a cotton-based activewear brand.
Miller said some of her clients have concerns over the health effects of synthetic plastic-based fabrics, but it remains to be seen if cotton can serve the purpose of something like nylon or spandex. Miller's trying to make a cotton fabric that has the same kind of stretchiness.
It fits when we first put it on, but after, you know, 6 hours of wearing it, it kind of loses the ability to stay tight on the waist or something like that. So we've been working on figuring out the exact way to mill the fabric.
Cotton growers hope that those kinds of advances, along with some help from Congress, will help keep their industry healthy for a while longer.
That was Michael Marks reporting for Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms covering agriculture, food systems, and rural issues. Still to come on this Monday's Main Street, the first day of school is almost here. North Dakota Teacher of the Year Franny Tunseth returns for more suggestions for our students to prepare them for schools, and she has suggestions for parents as well. That's still ahead on Main Street. Glad you're with us. Stay tuned. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Pleased to have Franny Tunseth, North Dakota's Teacher of the Year, back with us here on Main Street. Last week, we began discussing what we should be thinking as parents and what students should be thinking as they head back to the classroom this fall. And we have a little more of our conversation still in front of us. Franny, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. I love being here.
There's so much to talk about around this little topic of school's going to start, right? Not a little topic at all, but I want to begin with behavior that's different at school, Franny, than it is at home. Mm-hmm. And if our child, we're told, is doing so well at school, but comes home and just falls apart, what might a pattern like that be saying to us?
I think sometimes children hold it together all day because they know home is their safe place. Schools ask a lot of our children, academically, socially, emotionally, and when they walk through that door at home, they finally feel safe enough to let those feelings out. And as hard as that can be for parents, I try to remember that being the place where my child can fall apart is really actually a gift. It doesn't mean we allow disrespectful behavior, but it does mean that we can meet them with connection before correction. So you had a really big day. You don't have to hold it all together here. You know, sometimes we need a snack, some quiet time, outside time. Sometimes it's just a great big hug, or simply letting them know that home is the place where they don't have to be perfect. And our children need somewhere where they can take that armor off. And as a parent, I want to be that place. I also think that's important information for the school to know, though, because again, that partnership and letting teachers know what's going on at home can have a direct impact in school. And so maybe even as a teacher, there's something that I can be doing at the end of the day to help give them some de-escalation time before we go back home as well.
We've talked about that teacher-parent partnership often, Franny. What can you tell us about taking that next step about, you know what, maybe we should include a counselor now, or maybe a special ed professional, or maybe a medical person, or another specialist of some type? How do we foster those conversations, and how do we know when it's time to maybe reach for even more help?
Yeah, that's a great question, Craig. I think that it really comes back again to partnership. When we are all Team Kid and we have a dialogue that has been going on since the very first day of school, I think that these conversations very naturally occur. I think it's really important that we're not waiting until everyone is overwhelmed. The student, the parents, the teacher, if we're all overwhelmed, we're not making really good choices. So I think the first thing that you should do is start with a classroom teacher because they see your child in a different environment and can help you understand what they're noticing at school. And if concerns are continuing and it affects your students' learning or well-being and it seems to be bigger than what the classroom's teachers can address alone, that's when it makes sense to bring in a counselor, a special educational professional, a pediatrician, or another specialist. And I will say from my time in education, a lot of time, a teacher might even be the one to be suggesting these things. Mm-hmm. Hey, these are the things that are going on in the classroom, and I think we need more help. And more help isn't a bad thing.
How do parents protect that in still giving their kids confidence, yet recognizing more help's needed?
Yeah. You know, I think, Craig, it goes back to that, like, well, first of all, it doesn't need to be an either or decision. I think that reaching out to these other professionals doesn't mean something is quote unquote wrong with your child. It simply means that we're gathering the right people around that child. And the goal is always the same, team kids. So when families, school professionals communicate early, they listen to one another and they share what they're seeing, we have a much better chance of understanding what a child needs and really helping them thrive. But I think, again, it's just realizing that, you know what, the more people that you can bring on to Team Kid, I think the more chance they have to be successful.
Okay, so parents and teachers have went down the road. Yep. They've asked for help, but still believe the parents might that their kids' needs aren't being met. Mm-hmm. What's the next step? How does that work?
Yeah, well, I would tell parents, number one, you're always allowed to ask. If you want like an additional evaluation or additional referrals, you don't have to be an educator or know the right terminology to say, gosh, I'm really concerned about my child and I'd like to understand what supports might be available. Again, I think that the classroom teacher is always the best person to start with. But if you're not getting the answers that you want, or if things still kind of don't feel right, then most schools have an intervention team where there's an interventionist or a counselor, special education staff, the administrator. I think being able to ask the questions, share what you're seeing at home, and not being afraid to say, I'm not sure what my child needs, but I know something isn't working. As an interventionist, I see how powerful it can be when a family speaks up early. Asking for support isn't labeling a child or lowering expectations. It's simply making sure we understand how that child learns best and giving them the tools that they need to be successful. And I think parents are an incredibly important voice on Team Kid, and they know their child better than anybody else. And so if they're saying something isn't quite right, as a school, we need to pause and we need to take that seriously.
Franny, let's turn the page a little bit. Talk about friendships and behavior and belonging. I've got to believe that friendships are so important to success at school, a sense of belonging. Am I right about that?
I firmly believe so. I don't think that a child can fully separate learning from how they feel when they walk into a classroom. When a child feels known, accepted, and they feel like they belong, they're more willing to take risks, to ask questions, to make mistakes, to try again. I think when children are worried about how they fit, or if they're worrying about who they're going to sit with at lunch, or whether they're going to have a friend to play with at recess.
Wait, you just described somebody that I'm thinking about in my life. Oh, who's going to be at lunch?
And I think, gosh, Craig, I'm going to tell you a real story. I went the other day to a PD and I walked in and I was the presenter and I knew nobody else there. And as I was walking in,
what's
I knew
a PD?
I was walking for lunch, professional development, sorry. So I was walking in to present at a professional development and I knew I was walking in at lunchtime. And in my head, I go, gosh, I wonder if there's going to be a place for me at a table. And I'm a growing woman. And so you have to think about how our kids are feeling too, right? And if they're using all of their mental energy to worry about these things, their brain isn't ready to learn. I believe belonging creates the safety that makes learning possible. So as a teacher and as a parent, I want every child to have at least one person at school who knows their name, notices when they're having a hard day, and is genuinely glad that they're there. And sometimes that connection in the doorway is everything else to learning throughout the entire day.
Yeah. What should a parent do, Franny, when a child has trouble making friends and feels left out?
I think the first thing there is to listen without immediately trying to fix it. And I think that's another common theme that we've talked about. We want our students to be able to advocate for themselves and persevere and have some of that grit. I think if your child is continuing to say things like, nobody wants to play with me, I think it's okay to sit with that feeling and ask some gentle follow-up questions like, tell me what happened. Who did you try to play with? Sometimes children need help figuring out what to do next. And sometimes they simply need to know that someone understands how hard it feels. I think we can also help them practice small concrete skills. So like in kindergarten, how do we ask someone to play? How do we ask to join a group that's already playing a game you want to play? How do we handle a disagreement, or how to find another person who might be a good friend? I talk with my own kids a lot about how does that person make you feel on the inside? And is that somebody that you want to be around? I think if it continues and if you continue to hear things like that, again, it's really important to bring the teacher into the conversation, maybe even the counselor into the conversation, because I think both teachers and counselors can often see social dynamics that parents can't see at home because they aren't there in the school watching these things play out in real time. And I think most importantly, Craig, I think it's really important to remind your child that having a hard time finding their people right now doesn't mean that anything is wrong with them. Friendships take time, and every child deserves to know that they are worthy of being included and worthy of being accepted as they are, because all kids have incredibly great characteristics and traits to share with other people.
What about when the child comes home, Branny, and the parents sense right away, my kid's being bullied.
Yeah.
He's being bullied at school. Mm-hmm. What do I do? What should we do?
I think the first thing is to listen and to believe your child and to take it seriously. You know, most schools have formal bullying policies and procedures in place to help protect kids. And so if your child is coming home and you really believe they are being bullied, you have to reach out to the administration and to start that process. If the concern isn't being resolved or if the situation is really serious, families should reach out again to that school administration and ask what steps are being taken to keep their child safe. And I think that you don't need to be angry or confrontational when that's happening. You can come in as a partner. This is what our child is experiencing, and can you help us understand what the next steps are? All children deserve to feel safe at school, and a parent should never be afraid to advocate for that.
Let's turn the page there and learn maybe that my kid is the one who's been teasing, who's been excluding others, who's been bullying someone else. And I've just learned that. Mm-hmm. What should the parent feel, and maybe what should the parent do in that situation?
Oh my goodness, Craig. I think that that can be incredibly hard for a parent, because none of us want to hear that our child has hurt another child. I think we also have to separate the behavior from the child. We can say what you did was not okay, and we're going to walk through this together without saying like, you are a bad kid, right? All kids make bad mistakes. It doesn't mean that they are a bad kid. I would listen, talk to the teacher, and help my child understand the impact of their choices. I think you can ask questions to help build empathy. How do you think that made the other child feel? What can you do to make this right? I think accountability matters, but so does restoration. Our children are still learning how to be good humans, and sometimes they're going to get it wrong. And our job isn't to excuse harmful behavior. It's to help them own it, to repair it, and to learn how to make better choices the next time.
Enjoying my conversation with Branny Tunseth. She and I are talking about getting kids and families ready to go back to school. And Branny, there is a time when parents want to help, but have limited time, limited money as school begins, tough transportation situations, or even limited confidence in their own academic skills. How can they help their kids? What form of parental support matters most and really costs nothing?
I love this question, Craig, because I think sometimes we make supporting our child's learning feel much more complicated or expensive than it actually needs to be. The things that matter most often, first of all, cost absolutely nothing. Talk to your child, ask questions, make sure that you are present and being able to listen to their answers, read together, tell stories, play a game, cook dinner and talk about what you're doing, or simply take a walk and be curious about the world together. You don't have to know how to solve their math homework or have a lot of time or resources. You can say things like, I don't know how to do this either. Let's figure it out together. I think what children need most is to know that their family cares about their learning, believes in their ability, and is interested in who they are becoming as tiny people. And I think that's the kind of support that's available to every single family, and it's incredibly powerful.
Some parents, they might have had bad experiences at school themselves, Franny. So how can they keep those memories from shaping their own child's expectations?
So true, Craig. I was actually just talking about this with another parent this weekend, and I think it's such an important conversation because our experiences in school can stay with us for a very long time.
We all remember things that happened in school, even though it may have happened 60 years ago.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes we don't even realize how much those experiences are shaping the way that we talk about school with our own children or with other people. And if school was incredibly painful for us, I think we have to be very careful to not unintentionally hand that fear to our children. So I do think you could be honest about your experiences without making them your child's expectations. Maybe it's saying, school was really hard for me, but your experiences are going to be so much better. If something's really difficult, know you can always come and talk to me. I don't think we have to pretend our experiences didn't happen. We just don't want our past to become our child's future. And given your child permission to build their own relationship with school, with their teachers, and with learning, while knowing that you're going to be there to support them along the way is incredibly important.
There are going to be parents who are listening that are going to take their kids to school in that first few days, that first few weeks. They are going to feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Not to say that their kids may not also be overwhelmed too, but certainly they are all of a sudden overwhelmed with so many things that are happening at that time. Mm-hmm. Who should they reach out to, Franny? Is there someone within the school that can indirectly help the kiddo by helping the parent?
Absolutely. Craig, I think the most important thing is to always start with the classroom teacher. You don't have to understand all the acronyms or the processes or the school systems to ask for help. You could simply say, I'm not sure where to start, but I'm concerned about my child and I need some help understanding what comes next. A good teacher is going to be able to help connect those people, to the right resources. And if the concern goes beyond the classroom, they can help bring in the people like a counselor, an interventionist, a special ed member, or maybe it's an administrator. But parents should never feel like they have to navigate the school system alone, because as educators, it's our job to help them understand the system in a way that is understandable and welcoming.
Franny, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, and this has been fascinating, it sure brings me back to the time where I wish I still had kids in my family that were getting ready for school. But if families could make one or two changes at home this school year, what would you encourage them to think about?
Yeah. If a family can only make one or two changes, I would start with connection and routine. Make time every day to talk to your child and to really listen. To pause, Craig, and really take in what they're saying. Ask them about their day, read together, or simply sit and have a conversation without a screen in between them. And then I think create a predictable routine around sleep, helping them get ready for school, helping them figure out when or where they're going to work on homework and bedtime. It doesn't have to be perfect, and there's going to have to be flexibility when all of the other school events are happening. But I think more than anything, if we have connection and routine, our children are going to know that they are loved, that they belong, and they have adults that are in their corner. And I think we're giving them a really strong foundation for everything else that they're going to need to learn this year.
All right. Finally, Franny, what do you want children and maybe the adults raising them to encourage them to think about? What do you want children to remember as they begin a new school year?
You know, Craig, the more that I sit on this question, I'm really just thinking that I want children to remember that learning is joyful. There are going to be hard days. They're going to make mistakes, but they're going to learn things that come easy and things that maybe take a lot of practice. And none of those things change your worth. But there is learning that happens all around us, and it's supposed to be joyful. And I want adults to remember that, too. Our children don't need to get everything right. We don't need to be perfect. We need to show up, listen, encourage them, and remind them that we believe in them. I think school is so much bigger than grades and test scores. I know that's something that we've shared a lot of conversation about, Craig. It's really about becoming curious, confident, kind, resilient human beings. So my hope is that children are walking through our school doors knowing that they belong there, they're capable of learning, that they are loved, and that they have adults in their corner who believe in them.
You said the word I was going to throw out there at the end here. It's okay to be curious.
Okay to be curious.
Franny Tunseth, she's North Dakota's Teacher of the Year. She joins us periodically on Main Street with practical guidance for helping children build confidence, develop strong learning habits, and feel supported at home and at school. Franny, as always, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your experiences, and for helping families begin this school year. And I also want to give you my best wishes on a great year for you and your kiddos in your classroom. They're lucky to have you.
Thank you, Craig. I really appreciate that.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Rick Gion, Major Gifts Manager here at Prairie Public. When you give to Prairie Public, you hear your donation at work. Your generosity helps everyone in the Prairie region have access to programs that educate, involve, and inspire. If you'd like to pay Prairie Public forward in an even more impactful way, I invite you to join our Investor Circle. It's a group of members who care deeply about Prairie Public and who want quality, non-commercial programming and fact-driven news to touch even more people in our communities. Become an Investor Circle member right now with a gift of $1,200 or more annually or at $100 per month. Go to prairiepublic.org/support for more details. And thank you for caring about Prairie Public.
Is Bird Note. Osprey are impressive birds of prey with a wingspan more than 5 feet across. They primarily eat fish. And this bird is delivering a fresh catch to his mate and chicks. Osprey pairs construct large, open stick nests, and they'll keep adding new material year after year. An established nest can get up to 6 feet wide and 12 feet tall. While the ospreys only occupy the upper portion of this structure, other birds take up residence below. For decades, researchers have observed small songbirds raising their young inside active osprey nests. Cavity nesting species like house sparrows and European starlings seem right at home in the stick structure's nooks and crannies. This unexpected living arrangement is a classic example of a survival strategy called protective nesting. Nesting birds, be they songbirds or raptors, must always be on the alert for egg-eating predators. But with pescatarians in the penthouse suite, the nest's smaller tenants get 24-hour security without ending up on the menu themselves. And if a raccoon dares to approach, they'll make sure the ospreys hear about it. There's nothing quite like a good neighbor. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 17th. In August of 1921, a wave of bank robberies swept through small towns across North Dakota. The first targets were banks in Honeyford and Niagara in Grand Forks County. On this date, the criminals struck again, this time at the Farmers State Bank in Lunds Valley, Mound Trail County. Between 3 and 4 in the morning, three heavily armed men broke into the bank and attempted to gain access to the safe. The robbers detonated seven explosive charges, destroying both the safe and part of the building. Despite the extensive damage, they failed to reach the money and escaped with less than $5 in change. Investigators believed the gang ran out of explosives before they could complete the robbery. The explosions awakened residents of Lunds Valley, but efforts to stop the thieves were hampered because the town's telephone and telegraph lines had been cut beforehand. Before leaving town, the robbers reportedly stole a 1917 Ford touring car. They drove to a local oil station, forced open the pump, and filled the vehicle's tank before continuing their escape. The gang's crime spree eventually came to an end following the shooting of police officer Barney Busson and Renville County Deputy Sheriff John Powers a couple of weeks later, on August 29th. Both men survived their injuries. The incident led authorities to a group of outlaws known as the Kenmore Gang, who were involved in whiskey-running activities despite prohibition. Following his arrest in September of 1921, gang member Frank Kerr confessed to participating in multiple robberies and car thefts. He also admitted involvement in the shootings of Busson and Powers. Officials in Ward County believed the gang was responsible for a string of crimes throughout northwestern North Dakota. During the summer of 1921, the region experienced an average of three robberies per week. After the gang's arrest, reports of similar robberies ceased, bringing an end to one of the area's most active crime sprees. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Grace Kaiser. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
President Trump's Middle East special envoy, Jared Kushner, meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The meeting comes as the U.S. is pushing a 15-point roadmap for Hamas to disarm and for Israel to withdraw from Gaza. We hear what progress was made on the stalled Gaza ceasefire on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Monday edition of Main Street here on member-supported Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on Main Street, why rural newspapers still matter in North Dakota. Jill Fries, owner of GS Publishing, owns and operates 7 weekly newspapers in the southwest corner of North Dakota. She'll join Main Street to discuss the fight to preserve rural newspapers, deliver trusted local reporting, and keep government accountable across the state. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.